Freedom of the Will by Jonathan Edwards, Part 4, Section 6. For the sermon audio series, it is Part 14. Concerning that objection against the doctrine which has been maintained, that it agrees with the Stoical doctrine of fate and the opinions of Mr. Hobbes. When Calvinists oppose the Arminian notion of the freedom of will and contingence of volition, and insist that there are no acts of the will, nor any other events whatsoever, but what are attended with some kind of necessity, well, their opposers exclaim against them, as agreeing with the ancient Stoics in their doctrine of fate, and with Mr. Hobbes in his opinion of necessity. It would not be worthwhile to take notice of so impertinent an objection, had it not been urged by some of the chief Arminian writers. And there were many important truths maintained by the ancient Greek and Roman philosophers, and especially the Stoics, that are never the worse for being held by them. The Stoic philosophers, by the general agreement of Christian divines, and even Arminian divines, were the greatest, wisest, and most virtuous of all the heathen philosophers, and in their doctrine and practice came the nearest to Christianity of any of their sects. How frequently are the sayings of these philosophers, in many of the writings and sermons, even of Arminian divines, produced, not as arguments for the falseness of the doctrines which they delivered, but as a confirmation of some of the greatest truths of the Christian religion relating to the unity and perfections of the Godhead, a future state, the duty and happiness of mankind, etc., and how the light of nature and reason in the wisest and best of the heathen harmonized with and confirms the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it is very remarkable concerning Dr. Whitby that although he alleges the agreement of the Stoics with us, wherein he supposes they maintained the like doctrine as an argument against the truth of ours, yet this very Dr. Whitby alleges the agreement of the Stoics with the Arminian, wherein he supposes they taught the same doctrine with them, as an argument for the truth of their doctrine. And so that, when the Stoics agree with them, it is a confirmation of their doctrine, and a confutation of ours, as showing that our opinions are contrary to the natural sense and common reason of mankind. Now, nevertheless, when the Stoics agree with us, it argues no such thing in our favor, but, on the contrary, is a great argument against us, and shows our doctrine to be heathenish. It is observed by some Calvinistic writers that the Arminians symbolize with the Stoics in some of those doctrines wherein they are opposed by the Calvinists, particularly in their denying an original, innate, total corruption and utter depravity of heart, and in what the held of natural of man's ability to make himself truly virtuous and conform to God, and in some other doctrines. It may be further observed that certainly it is no better objection against our doctrine that it agrees, in some respects, with the doctrine of the ancient Stoic philosophers than it is against theirs, wherein they differ from us, that it agrees, in some respects, with the opinion of the very worst of the heathen philosophers, the followers of Epicurus, the father of atheism, and licentiousness, and with the doctrine of the Sadducees, and Jesuits. I am not much concerned to know precisely what the ancient Stoic philosophers held concerning fate, in order to determine what is truth, as though it were a sure way to be in the right, to take good heed to differ from them. It seems that they differed among themselves, and probably the doctrine of fate, what we would call fatalism, as maintained by most of them, was, in some respects, erroneous. But whatever their doctrine was, if any of them held such a fate as is repugnant to any liberty, consisting in our doing as we please, I utterly deny such a fate. If they held any such fate as is not consistent with the common and universal notions that mankind have of liberty, activity, moral agency, virtue, and vice, I disclaim any such thing, and think I have demonstrated that the scheme I maintain is no such scheme. If the Stoics, by fate, meant anything of such a nature as can be supposed to stand in the way of advantage and benefit of in use of means and endeavors, or would make it less worthwhile for men to desire and seek after anything wherein their virtue and happiness consists, I hold no doctrine that is clogged with any such inconvenience, any more than any other scheme whatsoever, and by no means so much as the Arminian scheme of contingents, as has been shown. If they held any such doctrine of universal fatality, as is inconsistent with any kind of liberty, that is or can be any perfection, dignity, privilege, or benefit, or anything desirable in any respect for any intelligent creature, or indeed with any liberty that is possible or conceivable, I embrace no such doctrine. If they held any such doctrine of fate as is inconsistent with the world being in all things subject to the disposal of an intelligent, wise agent that presides, not as the soul of the world, but as the sovereign lord of the universe, governing all things by proper will, choice, and design, in the exercise of the most perfect liberty conceivable, without subjection to any constraint, or being properly under the power or influence of anything before, above, or without himself, I wholly renounce any such doctrine. As to Mr. Hobbes maintaining the same doctrine concerning necessity, I confess, it happens that I never read Mr. Hobbes. Let his opinions, let his opinions be what it will. We need not reject all truth which is demonstrated by clear evidence merely because it was once held by some bad man. This great truth, quote, that the Lord Jesus Christ is the Son of God, close quote, was not spoiled because it was once and again proclaimed with a loud voice by the devil. If truth is so defiled because it is spoken by the mouth or written by the pen of some ill-minded, mischievous man or mischievous man, that it must never be received, well, we shall never know. When we hold any of the most precious and evident truths by a sure tenure, and if Mr. Hobbes has made a bad use of this truth, that is to be lamented. But the truth is not to be thought worthy of rejection on that account. It is common for the corrupt hearts of evil men to abuse the best things to vile purposes. I might also take notice of its having been observed that the Arminians agree with Mr. Hobbes in many more things than the Calvinists, as in what he is said to hold concerning original sin, in denying the necessity of supernatural illumination, in denying infused grace, in denying the doctrine of justification by faith alone, and other things. Section 7. Concerning the necessity of the divine will. Some may, possibly, object against what has been supposed of the absurdity and inconsistency of a self-determining power in the will, and the impossibility of its being otherwise than that the will should be determined in every case by some motive, and by a motive which, as it stands in the view of the understanding, is of superior strength to any appearing on the other side. That if these things are true, it will follow that not only the will of created minds, but the will of God himself is necessary in all its determinations. Concerning which the author of the essay on the freedom of the will in God and in the creature, that's page 85 and 86, says, quote, "What strange doctrine is this? Contrary to all our ideas of the dominion of God, does it not destroy the glory of his liberty of choice and take away from the creator and governor and benefactor of the world, that most free and sovereign agent, all the glory of this sort of freedom? Does it not seem to make him a kind of mechanical medium of fate and introduce Mr. Hobbes' doctrine of fatality and necessity into all things that God hath to do with? Does it not seem to represent the blessed God as being of vast understanding as well as power and efficiency, but still to leave him without a will to choose among all the objects within his view? In short, it seems to make the blessed God a sort of almighty minister of fate under its universal and supreme influence, as it was the professed sentiment of some of the ancients that fate was above the gods." Well, this is declaiming rather than arguing, and an application to men's imaginations and prejudices rather than to mere reason. I would now calmly endeavor to consider whether there be any reason in this frightful representation. But before I enter upon a particular consideration of the matter, I would observe that it is reasonable to suppose it should be much more difficult to express or conceive things according to exact metaphysical truth relating to the nature and manner of the existence of things in the divine understanding and will, and the operation of these faculties, if I may so call them, of the divine mind, than in the human mind, which is infinitely more within our view, more proportionate to the measure of our comprehension, and more commensurate to the use and import of human speech. Language is indeed very deficient in regard of terms to express precise truth concerning our own minds and their faculties and operations. Words were first formed to express external things, and those that are applied to express things internal and spiritual are almost all borrowed and used in a sort of figurative sense, whence they are, most of them, attended with a great deal of ambiguity and unfixedness in their signification, occasioning innumerable doubts, difficulties, and confusions in inquiries and controversies about things of this nature. But language is much less adapted to express things existing in the mind of the incomprehensible deity, precisely as they are. We find a great deal of difficulty in conceiving exactly of the nature of our own souls, and notwithstanding all the progress which has been made in past ages and the present in this kind of knowledge, whereby our metaphysics, as it relates to these things, is brought to greater perfection than once it was, yet here is still work enough left for future inquiries and researches, and room for progress still to be made for many ages and generations. But we had need to be infinitely able metaphysicians to conceive with clearness, according to strict, proper, and perfect truth, concerning the nature of the divine essence and the modes of action and operation in the powers of the divine mind. And it may be noted particularly that though we are obliged to conceive of some things in God as consequent and dependent on others, and of some things pertaining to the divine nature and will as the foundation of others, and so before others in the order of nature, as we must conceive of the knowledge and holiness of God as prior in the order of nature to his happiness, the perfection of his understanding as the foundation of his wise purposes and decrees, the holiness of his nature as the cause and reason of his holy determinations. And yet, when we speak of cause and effect, antecedent and consequent, fundamental and dependent, determining and determined, in the first being, who is self-existent, independent, of perfect and absolute simplicity and immutability, and the first cause of all things, doubtless there must be less propriety in such representations than when we speak of derived dependent beings, who are compounded and liable to perpetual mutation and succession. Excuse me. Having premised this, I proceed to observe concerning the forementioned author's exclamation about the necessary determination of God's will in all things by what he sees to be fittest and best. That all the seeming force of such objections and exclamations must arise from an imagination that there is some sort of privilege or dignity in being without such a moral necessity as will make it impossible to do any other than always choose what is wisest and best, as though there were some disadvantage or meanness and subjection in such a necessity, a thing by which the will was confined, or kept under, and held in servitude by something which, as it were, maintained a strong and invincible power and dominion over it, by bonds that held him fast, and from which he could, by no means, deliver himself. Whereas, this must be all mere imagination and delusion. It is no disadvantage or dishonor to a being necessarily to act in the most excellent and happy manner from the necessary perfection of his own nature. And this argues no imperfection, inferiority, or dependence, nor any lack of dignity, privilege, or ascendancy. It is not inconsistent with the absolute and most perfect sovereignty of God The sovereignty of God is his ability and authority to do whatever pleases him, whereby, quote, he doth according to his will in the armies of heaven and amongst the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? The following things belong to the sovereignty of God. Number one, supreme, universal, and infinite power, whereby he is able to do what he pleases without control, without any confinement of that power, without any subjection in the least measure to any other power, and so without any hindrance or restraint that it should be either impossible or at all difficult for him to accomplish his will, and without any dependence of his power on any other power from whence it should be derived, or of which it should stand in any need. So far from this, that all other power is derived from him, and that is absolutely dependent on him. Number two, that he has supreme authority, absolute and most perfect right to do what he wills without subjection to any superior authority or any derivation of authority from any other, or limitation by any distinct independent authority, either superior, equal, or inferior. He, being the head of all dominion and fountain of all authority, and also without restraint by any obligation, implying either subjection, derivation, or dependence, or proper limitation. Number three, that his will is supreme, underived, and independent on anything without himself, being in everything determined by his own counsel, having no other rule but his own wisdom, his will not being subject to or restrained by the will of any other, and other wills being perfectly subject to his. Number four, that his wisdom, which determines his will, is supreme, perfect, underived, self-sufficient, and independent, so that it may be said, as in Isaiah 1, Isaiah XL 14, sorry, I know what it is, but it's not coming to me. Isaiah 40, verse 14, quote, with whom took he counsel? And who instructed him and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed him the way of understanding? Close quote. There is no other divine sovereignty but this, and this is properly absolute sovereignty. No other is desirable, nor would any other be honorable or happy. And indeed, there is no other conceivable or possible. It is the glory and greatness of the divine sovereign that his will is determined by his own infinite, all-sufficient wisdom in everything, and is in nothing at all directed either by inferior wisdom or by no wisdom, whereby it would become senseless and arbitrariness. determining and acting without reason, design, or end. Now, if you believe that today, I'm going to just make a comment. If you believe these things today, you immediately get labeled a hyper-Calvinist. And you know it's true. Back to the reading. If God's will is steadily and surely determined in everything by supreme wisdom, then it is in everything necessarily determined to that which is most wise. And certainly, it would be a disadvantage and indignity to be otherwise. For if the divine will was not necessarily determined to what in every case is wisest and best, it must be subject to some degree of undesigning contingents, and so in the same degree liable to evil. To suppose the divine will liable to be carried hither and thither at random by the uncertain wind of blind contingents, which is guided by no wisdom, no motive, no intelligent dictate whatsoever, if any such thing were possible, would certainly argue a great degree of imperfection and meanness, infinitely unworthy of the deity. If it be a disadvantage for the divine will to be attended with this moral necessity, then the more free from it, and the more left at random, the greater dignity and advantage. And, consequently, to be perfectly free from the direction of understanding, and universally and entirely left to senseless, unmeaning continence, to act absolutely at random, would be the supreme glory. And it no more argues any dependence of God's will that his supremely wise volition is necessary, than it argues that a dependence of his being, that is, existence, is necessary. If it be something too low for the supreme being to have his will determined by moral necessity, so as necessarily in every case to will in the highest degree, holily and happily, then why is it not also something too low for him to have his existence, and the infinite perfection of his nature, and his infinite happiness determined by necessity? It is no more to God's dishonor to be necessarily wise than to be necessarily holy. And if neither of them be, is the beauty of this necessity, that it is strong as faith itself, with all the advantage of reason and goodness, it is strange to see men contend that the deity is not free, because he is necessarily rational, immutably good to his dishonor. Then it is not to his dishonor necessarily to act holily and wisely. And if it be not dishonorable to be necessarily holy and wise in the highest possible degree, no more is it mean and dishonorable necessarily to act holily and wisely in the highest possible degree, or, which is the same thing, to do that, well, in every case, which, above all other things, is wisest and best. Well, the reason why it is not dishonorable to be necessarily most holy is because holiness in itself is an excellent and honorable thing. For the same reason, it is no dishonor to be necessarily most wise, and in every case to act most wisely, or do the thing which is the wisest of all. For wisdom is also in itself excellent and honorable. The forementioned author of the essay on the freedom of will, etc., as has been observed, represents that doctrine of the divine will being in everything necessarily determined by superior fitness, as making the blessed God a kind of almighty minister and mechanical medium of fate. Well, he insists in pages 93 and 94 that this moral necessity and impossibility is, in effect, the same thing with physical and natural necessity and impossibility. And says in pages 54 and 55, quote, "The scheme which determines the will, always and certainly by the understanding, and the understanding by the appearance of things, seems to take away the true nature of vice and virtue. For the sublimest of virtues and the vilest of vices seem rather to be matters of fate and necessity, flowing naturally and necessarily from the existence, the circumstances, and present situation of persons and things. For this existence and situation necessarily makes such an appearance to the mind, and from this appearance flows a necessary perception and judgment concerning these things. This judgment necessarily determines the will, and thus, by this chain of necessary causes, virtue and vice would lose their nature and become natural ideas and necessary things instead of moral and free actions." Close quote. And yet, this same author allows, in pages 30 and 31, that a perfectly wise being will constantly and certainly choose what is most fit, and says, in pages 102 and 103, quote, "I grant, and always have granted, that wheresoever there is such antecedent, superior fitness of things, God acts according to it, so as never to contradict it, and particularly in all his judicial proceedings as a governor and distributor of rewards and punishments." Close quote. Yea, he says expressly in page 42, quote, "that it is not possible for God to act otherwise than according to this fitness and goodness in things." Close quote. So that, according to this author, putting these several passages of his essay together, there is no virtue, nor anything of a moral nature, in the most sublime and glorious acts and exercises of God's holiness, justice, and faithfulness. And he never does anything which is in itself supremely worthy, and above all other things, fit and excellent, but only as a kind of mechanical medium of fate, and in what he does as the judge and moral governor of the world. He exercises no moral excellency, exercising no freedom in these things, because he acts by moral necessity, which is, in effect, the same with physical or natural necessity. And therefore, he only acts by an hobbitistical fatality. Close quote. As a being indeed of vast understanding. Actually, this is the quote here. Sorry about the direction here. This text is kind of strange, the way it's printed out here. Quote, "As a being indeed of vast understanding, as well as power and efficiency, as he said before, but without a will to choose, being a kind of almighty minister of fate, acting under its supreme influence. For he allows that in all these things, God's will is determined consistently and certainly by a superior fitness, and that it is not possible for him to act otherwise. And if these things are so," by the way, you can close the quote on that. "And if these things are so, What glory or praise belongs to God for doing holily and justly, or taking the most fit, holy, wise, and excellent course in any one instance? Whereas, according to the Scriptures, and also the common sense of mankind, it does not, in the least, derogate from the honor of any being that, through the moral perfection of his nature, he necessarily acts with supreme wisdom and holiness. But on the contrary, his praise is the greater, and herein consists the height of his glory. And the same author, on page 56, supposes that herein appears the excellent, quote, character of a wise and good man, that though he can choose contrary to the fitness of things, yet he does not, but suffers himself, that's allows himself, to be directed by fitness, close quote, and that in this conduct, quote, he imitates the blessed God, close quote. And yet, he supposes it contrariwise with the blessed God, and not that he suffers himself, or not that he suffers himself to be directed by fitness, when he, quote, can choose contrary to the fitness of things, close quote, but that, quote, he cannot choose contrary to the fitness of things, close quote, as he says in page 42. Here's another quote from this author, that it is not possible for God to act otherwise than according to this fitness, where there is any fitness or goodness in things. Close quote. Sorry, guys, about all the quotes. This is the way it's out in the text. Yea, he supposes, in page 31, that if a man, quote, were perfectly wise and good, he could not do otherwise than be constantly and certainly determined by the fitness of things, close quote. One more thing I would observe before I conclude this section, and that is, that if it derogate nothing from the glory of God to be necessarily determined by superior fitness in some things, then neither does it to be thus determined in all things, from anything in the nature of such necessity, as at all detracting from God's freedom, independence, absolute supremacy, or any dignity or glory of his nature, state, or manner of acting, or as implying any infirmity, restraint, or subjection. And if the thing be such as well consists with God's glory, and has nothing tending at all to detract from it, then we need not be afraid of ascribing it to God in too many things, lest thereby we should detract from God's glory too much. Section 8. Some further objections against the moral necessity of God's volitions considered. The author last cited, as has been observed, owns that God, being perfectly wise, will constantly and certainly choose what appears most fit, where there is a superior fitness and goodness in things, and that it is not possible for him to do otherwise, so that it is in effect confessed that in those things where there is any real preferableness, it is no dishonor, nothing in any respect unworthy of God for him to act from necessity, notwithstanding all that can be objected from the agreement of such a necessity with the fate of the Stoics, and the necessity maintained by Mr. Hobbes, from which it will follow that if in all the different things among which God chooses, there were evermore a superior fitness or preferableness on one side, then it would be no dishonor or anything unbecoming for God's will to be necessarily determined in everything. excuse me. And if this be allowed, it is giving up entirely the argument from the unsuitableness of such a necessity to the liberty, supremacy, independence, and glory of the divine being, and resting the whole weight of the affair on the decision of another point completely diverse. That is to say, whether it be so indeed that in all the various possible things which are in God's view and may be considered as capable objects of his choice, there is not evermore a preferableness in one thing above another. Well, this is denied by this author. That's Edwards, I believe, speaking of himself, who supposes that in many instances, between two or more possible things which come within the view of the divine mind, there is a perfect indifference and inequality as to fitness or tendency to attain any good end which God can have in view, or to answer any of his designs. Now, therefore, I would consider whether this be evident. The arguments brought to prove this are of two kinds. Number one, it is urged that, in many instances, we must suppose there is absolutely no difference between various possible objects of choice which God has in view, and, number two, that the difference between many things is so inconsiderable, or of such a nature that it would be unreasonable to suppose it to be of any consequence, or to suppose that any of God's wise designs would not be answered in any one way as well as the other. Therefore, number one, the first thing to be considered is whether there are any instances wherein there is a perfect likeness and absolutely no difference between different objects of choice that are proposed to the divine understanding. And here, in the first place, it may be worthy to be considered whether the contradiction there is in the terms of the question proposed does not give reason to suspect that there is an inconsistency in the thing supposed. It is inquired whether different objects of choice may not be absolutely without difference. Well, if they are absolutely without difference, then how are they different objects of choice? If there be absolutely no difference in any respect, then there's no variety or distinction, for distinction is only by some difference. And if there be no variety among proposed objects of choice, then there is no opportunity for variety of choice or difference of determination. For that determination of a thing which is not different in any respect is not a different determination but the same. That this is no quibble may appear more fully in a short time. The arguments to prove that the Most High, in some instances, chooses to do one thing rather than another, where the things themselves are perfectly without difference, are two. Number one, that the various parts of infinite time and space, absolutely considered, are perfectly alike, and do not differ at all one from another, and that therefore, when God determined to create the world in such a part of infinite duration and space rather than others, he determined and preferred among various objects between which there was no preferableness and absolutely no difference. Well, answer. Well, this objection supposes an infinite length of time before the world was created, distinguished by successive parts, properly and truly so, or a succession of limited and unmeasurable periods of time, following one another, in an infinitely long series, which must needs be a groundless imagination. The eternal duration, which was before the world, being only the eternity of God's existence, which is nothing else but his immediate, perfect, and invariable possession of the whole of his unlimited life, together and at once, vitae interminabili, totu simul et perfecta possesso, which is so generally allowed that I need not stand to demonstrate it. So this objection supposes an extent of space beyond the limits of the creation, of an infinite length, breadth, and depth, truly and properly distinguished into different measurable parts, limited at certain stages, one beyond another, in an infinite series. Which notion of absolute and infinite space is doubtless as unreasonable as that now mentioned of absolute and infinite duration. It is as improper to imagine that the immensity and omnipresence of God is distinguished by a series of miles and leagues, one beyond another, as that the infinite duration of God is distinguished by months and years, one after another. A diversity and order of distinct parts, limited by certain periods, is as conceivable and does naturally obtrude itself on our imagination, in one case as the other, and there is equal reason in each case to suppose that our imagination deceives us. It is equally improper to talk of months and years of the divine existence as of square miles of deity, and we equally deceive ourselves when we talk of the world being differently fixed with respect to either of these sorts of measures. I think we know not what we mean if we say the world might have been differently placed from what it is in the broad expanse of infinity, or that it might have been differently fixed in the long line of eternity. And all arguments and objections which are built on the imaginations we are apt to have of infinite extension or duration are buildings founded on shadows or castles in the air. Number two, the second argument to prove that the Most High wills one time rather than another, without any superior fitness or preferableness in the thing preferred, is God's actually placing in different parts of the world panicles or atoms of matter that are perfectly equal and alike. The forementioned author says in page 78, etc., quote, if one would descend to the minute specific particles of which different bodies are composed, we should see abundant reason to believe that there are thousands of such little particles, or atoms of matter, which are perfectly equal and alike, and could give no distinct determination to the will of God where to place them. Close quote. Well, he there instances in particles of water, of which there are such immense numbers which compose the rivers and oceans of this world, and the infinite myriads of the luminous and fiery particles which compose the body of the sun, so many that it would be very unreasonable to suppose no two of them should be exactly equal and alike. Answer number one. To this I answer that as we must suppose matter to be infinitely divisible, it is very unlikely that any two of all these particles are exactly equal and alike, and so unlikely that it is 1,000 to 1, yea, an infinite number to one, but it is otherwise, and that although we should allow a great similarity between the different particles of water and fire as to their general nature and figure, and however small we suppose those particles to be, it is infinitely unlikely that any two of them should be exactly equal in dimensions and quantity of matter. If we should suppose a great many globes of the same nature with the globe of the earth, it would be very strange if there were any two of them that had exactly the same number of particles of dust and water in them. But infinitely less strange than that two particles of light should have just the same quantity of matter. For a particle of light, according to the doctrine of the infinite divisibility of matter, is composed of infinitely more assignable parts than there are particles of dust and water in the globe of the earth. And, as it is infinitely unlikely that any two of these particles should be equal, so it is that they should be alike in other respects, to instance, in the configuration of their surfaces. If there were very many globes of the nature of the earth, it would be very unlikely that any two should have exactly the same number of particles of dust, water, and stone in their surfaces, and all posited exactly alike, with one respect to another, without any difference, in any part discernible either by the naked eye or microscope. But infinitely less strange than that two particles of light should be perfectly of the same figure, for there are infinitely more assignable real parts on the surface of a particle of light than there are particles of dust, water, and stone on the surface of the terrestrial globe. Answer number two. But then, supposing that there are two particles, or atoms of matter, perfectly equal and alike, which God has placed in different parts of the creation, as I will not deny it to be possible for God to make two bodies perfectly alike, and put them in different places, yet it will not follow that two different or distinct acts or effects of the divine power have exactly the same fitness for the same end. For these two different bodies are not different or distinct in any other respects than those wherein they differ. They are two in no other respects than those wherein there is a difference. If they are perfectly equal and alike in themselves, then they can be distinguished or be distinct only in those things which are called circumstances, as place, time, rest, motion, or some other present or past circumstances or relations. For it is difference only that constitutes distinction. If God makes two bodies in themselves every way equal and alike, and agreeing perfectly in all other circumstances and relations, but only their place, then in this only is there any distinction or duplicity. The figure is the same. The measure is the same. The solidity and resistance are the same. And everything the same, but only the place. Therefore, what the will of God determines is this, that there should be the same figure, the same extension, the same resistance, etc., in two different places. And for this determination, he has some reason. There is some end for which such determination and act has a peculiar fitness above all other acts. Here is no one thing determined without an end, and no one thing without a fitness for that end superior to anything else. If it be the pleasure of God to cause the same resistance and the same figure to be in two different places and situations, we can no more justly argue from it that here must be some determination or act of God's will that is completely without motive or end, then we can argue that whenever, in any case, it is a man's will to speak the same words or to make the same sounds at two different times, there must be some determination or act of his will without any motive or end. The difference of place in the former case proves no more than the difference of time does in the other. If anyone should say, with regard to the former case, that there must be something determined without an end, meaning that if those two similar bodies, this in particular, should be made in this place, and the other in the other, and should inquire why the Creator did not make them in a transposition, when both are alike, and each would equally have suited either place. The inquiry supposes something that is not true, namely, that the two bodies differ and are distinct in other respects besides their place, so that with this distinction inherent in them, they might, in their first creation, have been transposed, and each might have begun its existence in the place of the other. Let us, for clearness' sake, suppose that God had, at the beginning, made two globes, each of an inch diameter, both perfect spheres, and perfectly solid, without pores, and perfectly alike in every respect, and placed them near one to another, one towards the right hand and the other towards the left, without any difference as to time, motion, or rest, past or present, or any circumstance, but only their place, and the creation should be asked, and the question should be asked, why God in their creation placed them so, why that which is made on the right hand was not made on the left, and vice versa, well, let it be well considered whether there be any sense in such a question, and whether the inquiry does not suppose something false and absurd. Let it be considered what the Creator must have done otherwise than he did, what different act of will or power he must have exerted in order to the thing proposed. All that could have been done would have been to have made two spheres, perfectly alike, in the same places where he has made them, without any difference of the things made, either in themselves or in any circumstance, so that the whole effect would have been without any difference, and, therefore, just the same. By the supposition, the two spheres are different in no other respect but their placement, and, therefore, in other respects, they are the same. Each has the same roundness. It is not a distinct rotundity in any other respect but its situation. And there are also the same dimensions, differing in nothing but their place, and so of their resistance and everything else that belongs to them. Well, here, if any chooses to say that there is a difference in another respect, that is to say that there are not numerically the same, that it is thus with all the qualities that belong to them, that it is confessed they are in some respects the same, that is, they are both exactly alike, but yet numerically they differ. Thus, the roundness of one is not the same numerical individual roundness with that of the other. Well, let this be supposed. Then the question about the determination of the divine will in the affair is, why did God will that this individual roundness should be at the right hand and the other individual roundness at the left? Why did he not make them in a contrary position? Let any rational person consider whether such questions be not words without a meaning, as much as if God should see fit for some ends to cause the same sounds to be repeated or made at two different times. The sounds being perfectly the same in every other respect, but only one was a minute after the other. And it should be asked upon it why God caused these sounds, numerically different, to succeed one the other in such a manner. Why did he not make that individual sound, which was in the first minute, to be in the second, and the individual sound of the last minute to be in the first? Which inquiries would be even ridiculous, as, I think, every person must see at once, in the case proposed of two sounds, being only the same repeated, absolutely without any difference, but that one circumstance of time. If the Most High sees it, will answer some good end, that the same sound be made thunder at two distinct times, and therefore wills that it should be so, must it needs therefore be that herein there is some act of God's will without any motive or end? God saw fit often, at distinct times, and on different occasions, to say the very same words to Moses, namely those, I am Jehovah. And would it not be unreasonable to infer, as a certain consequence from this, that here must be some act or acts of the divine will in determining and disposing the words exactly alike at different times, completely without aim or inducement? But it would be no more unreasonable than to say that there must be an act of God without any inducement, if he sees it best, and, for some reasons, determines that there shall be the same resistance, the same dimensions, and the same figure in several distinct places. If, in the instance of the two spheres, perfectly alike, it be supposed possible that God might have made them in a contrary position, that which is made at the right hand being made at the left, and then I ask whether it is not evidently equally possible, if God had made but one of them, and that in the place of the right hand globe, that he might have made that numerically different from what it is, and numerically different from what he did make it, though perfectly alike, and in the same place, and at the same time, and in every respect, in the same circumstances and relations. Namely, whether he might not have made it numerically the same with that which he has now made at the left hand, and so have left that which is now created at the right hand in a state of non-existence. And, if so, whether it would not have been possible to have made one in that place, perfectly like these, and yet numerically differing from both. And let it be considered whether, from this notion of a numerical difference in bodies, perfectly equal and alike, which numerical difference is something inherent in the bodies themselves, and diverse from the difference of place or time, or any circumstance whatsoever. Well, it will not follow that there is an infinite number of numerically different possible bodies, perfectly alike, among which God chooses by a self-determining power when he goes about to create bodies. Therefore, let us put the case thus. Supposing that God, in the beginning, had created but one perfectly solid sphere in a certain place, and that it should be inquired why God created that individual sphere in that place at that time, and why he did not create another sphere perfectly like it, but numerically different, in the same place at the same time, or why he chose to bring into being there that very body rather than any of the infinite number of other bodies perfectly like it, either of which he could have made there as well, and would have answered his end as well. Why he caused to exist at that place and time, then individual roundness, or that individual roundness, rather than any other of the infinite number of individual rotundities, just like it. Why that individual resistance, rather than any other of the infinite number of possible resistances, just like it. And it might be as reasonably asked. And it might as reasonably be asked. Why, when God first caused it to thunder, he caused that individual sound then to be made, and not another just like it? Why did he make choice of this very sound, and reject all the infinite number of other possible sounds just like it, but numerically differing from it, and all differing one from another? I think everybody must be sensible of the absurdity and nonsense of what is supposed in such inquiries. And if we calmly attend to the matter, we shall be convinced that all such kind of objections as I am answering are founded on nothing but the imperfection of our manner of conceiving things, and the obscureness of language, and great lack of clearness and precision in the signification of terms. If any should find fault with this reasoning, that it is going a great length into metaphysical niceties and subtleties, I answer, the objection to which they are a reply is a metaphysical subtlety, and must be treated according to the nature of it. Roman numeral number 2. Another thing alleged is that innumerable things which are determined by the divine will and chosen and done by God rather than others differ from those that are not chosen in so inconsiderable a manner that it would be unreasonable to suppose the difference to be of any consequence, or that there is any superior fitness or goodness that God can have respect to in the determination. To which I answer, it is impossible for us to determine without any certainty or evidence that because the difference is very small and appears to us of no consideration, therefore, there is absolutely no superior goodness and no valuable end which can be proposed by the Creator and Governor of the world in ordering such a difference. The forementioned author mentions many instances. One is there being one atom in the whole universe more. By the way, I'm saying atom, not Adam. There being one atom in the whole universe, more or less. But, I think, it would be unreasonable to suppose that God made one atom in vain, or without any end or motive. He made not one atom, but what was a work of his almighty power, as much as the whole globe of the earth, and requires as much of a constant exertion of almighty power to uphold it, and was made and is upheld with the understanding and design as much as if no other had been made but that. And it would be unreasonable to suppose that he made it without anything really aimed at in so doing, as much as to suppose that he made the planet Jupiter without aim or design. It is possible that the most minute effects of the Creator's power, the smallest assignable difference between the things which God has made, may be attended in the whole series of events, and the whole compass and extent of their influence, with very great and important consequences. If the laws of motion and gravitation laid down by Sir Isaac Newton hold universally, there is not one atom, nor the least assignable part of an atom, but what has influence every moment throughout the whole material universe to cause every part to be otherwise than it would be if it were not for that particular corporeal existence. And however the effect is insensible for the present, yet it may, in length of time, become great and important. To illustrate this, let us suppose two bodies moving the same way, in straight lines, perfectly parallel one to another, but to be diverted from this parallel course and drawn one from another, as much as might be, by the attraction of an atom, at the distance of one of the furthest of the fixed stars from the Earth. These bodies, being turned out of the lines of their parallel motion, will, by degrees, get further and further distant, one from the other. And though the distance may be imperceptible for a long time, yet at length it may become very great. So, the revolution of a planet round the sun being retarded or accelerated, and the orbit of its revolution made greater or less, and more or less elliptical, and so its periodical time longer or shorter, no more than may be by the influence of the least atom, might, in length of time, perform a whole revolution sooner or later than otherwise it would have done, which might make a vast alteration with regard to millions of important events. So, the influence of the least particle may, for aught we know, have such effect on something in the constitution of some human body as to cause another thought to arise in the mind at a certain time than otherwise would have been, which, in length of time, yea, and that not very great, might occasion a vast alteration through the whole world of mankind. And so innumerable other ways might be mentioned, wherein the least assignable alteration may possibly be attended with great consequences. Another argument which the forementioned author brings against a necessary determination of the divine will by a superior fitness is that such doctrine derogates from the freeness of God's grace and goodness in choosing the objects of his favor and bounty, and from the obligation upon men to thankfulness for special benefits. That's page 89, etc. In answer to this objection, I would observe, 1, that it derogates no more from the goodness of God to suppose the exercise of the benevolence of his nature to be determined by wisdom than to suppose it determined by chance, and that his favors are bestowed altogether at random, his will being determined by nothing but perfect accident, without any end or design whatsoever, which must be the case, as has been demonstrated, if volition be not determined by a prevailing motive. That which is owing to perfect contingence, wherein neither previous inducement nor antecedent choice has any hand, is not owing more to goodness or benevolence than that which is owing to the influence of a wise end. 2, it is acknowledged that if the motive that determines the will of God in the choice of the objects of his favors be any moral quality in the object, recommending that object to his benevolence above others, his choosing that object, is not so great a manifestation of the freeness and sovereignty of his grace, as it were otherwise. But there is no necessity for supposing this, in order to our supposing that he has some wise end in view, in determining to bestow his favors on one person rather than another. We are to distinguish between the merit of the object of God's favor, or a moral qualification of the object attracting that favor and recommending to it, and the natural fitness of such a determination of the act of God's goodness to answer some wise design of his own, some end in the view of God's omniscience. It is God's own act that is the proper and immediate object of his volition. 3, I suppose that none will deny, but that in some instances, God acts from wise design in determining the particular subjects of his favors. Well, none will say, I presume, that when God distinguishes, by his bounty, particular societies or persons, he never, in any instance, exercises any wisdom in so doing, aiming at some happy consequence. And if it be not denied to be so in some instances, then I would inquire whether in these instances God's goodness is less manifested than in all those wherein God has no aim or end at all, and whether the subjects have less cause of thankfulness. And if so, who shall be thankful for the bestowment of distinguishing mercy, with that enhancing circumstance of the distinction being made without an end? How shall it be known when God is influenced by some wise aim and when not? It is very manifest with respect to the Apostle Paul that God had wise ends in choosing him to be a Christian and an apostle, who had been a persecutor, etc. The apostle himself mentions one end, 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 15 and 16. Quote, Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am chief. Howbeit, for this cause I obtained mercy, that in me first Jesus Christ might show forth all long-suffering, for a pattern to them who should hereafter believe on him to life everlasting. Close quote. But yet the apostle never looked on it as a diminution of the freedom and riches or divine grace in his election, which he so often and so greatly magnifies. And this brings me to observe number 4, our supposing such a moral necessity in the acts of God's will, as has been spoken of, is so far from necessarily derogating from the riches of God's grace to such as are the chosen objects of his favor, that in many instances this moral necessity may arise from goodness and from the great degree of it. God may choose this object rather than another as having a superior fitness to answer the ends, designs, and inclinations of his goodness, being more sinful and so more miserable and necessitous than others. The inclinations of infinite mercy and benevolence may be more gratified, and the gracious design of God in sending his Son into the world may be more abundantly answered in the exercises of mercy towards such an object rather than another. One more thing I would observe before I finish what I have to say on the head of the necessity of the acts of God's will, and that is that something much more like a servile subjection of the divine being to fatal necessity will follow from Arminian principles than from the doctrines which they oppose. For they, at least most of them, suppose, with respect to all events that happen in the moral world, depending on the volitions of moral agents, which are the most important events of the universe, to which all others are subordinate. Well, I say, they suppose, with respect to these, that God has a certain foreknowledge of them, antecedent to any purposes or decrees of his about them. And if so, they have a fixed, certain futurity prior to any designs or volitions of his, and independent on them, and to which his volitions must be subject, as he would wisely accommodate his affairs to this fixed futurity of the state of things in the moral world. So that here, instead of a moral necessity of God's will arising from or consisting in the infinite perfection and blessedness of the divine being, We have a fixed, unalterable state of things, properly distinct from the perfect nature of the divine mind, and the state of the divine will and design, and entirely independent on these things, and which they have no hand in, because they are prior to them, and to which God's will is truly subject, being obliged to conform or accommodate himself to it, in all his purposes and decrees, and in everything he does in his disposals and government of the world. The moral world being the end of the natural, so that all is in vain that is not accommodated to that state of the moral world, which consists in or depends upon the acts and state of the wills of moral agents, which had a fixed futurition from eternity. Such a subjection to necessity as this would truly argue an inferiority and servitude that would be unworthy of the Supreme Being, and is much more agreeable to the notion which many of the heathen had of fate as above the gods, than that moral necessity of fitness and wisdom which has been spoken of, and is truly repugnant to the absolute sovereignty of God, and inconsistent with the supremacy of his will, and really subjects the will of the Most High to the will of his creatures, and brings him into dependence upon them.